Hello and welcome to Adjust Your Tracking, the film podcast with your host, Joe Von Oppen, and myself, Eric McClanahan. This show is presented by the Northwest Film Center. Last week, Joe and I discussed our most anticipated films of 2012, recommended a film in our laptop cinema segment, and also played our first round of Love It, Hate It. That episode is still available at newsroom.nwfilm.org, where you can find all episodes of the show by clicking on the podcast tab or scrolling down the main page. This week, with PIFF looming on the horizon in our fair city of Portland, Joe and I find time to discuss the recently announced Oscar nominations, and it quickly becomes clear that neither one of us really cares at all this year. And for those who just can't take the suspense, we do revisit Love It, Hate It to give our re-evaluations on our chosen films from last week. Before we kick off the show, though, it's worth noting to all our Portland listeners that the aforementioned PIFF, that's Portland International Film Festival, put on by the very same Northwest Film Center that makes this podcast possible, is less than a week away. Our opening night film, Salmon Fishing in Yemen, screens on Thursday, February 9th, and the festival goes through February 25th, with more than 80 features and shorts screened. Make sure to head to nwfilm.org for all information on the films and how to purchase tickets in advance. I also highly recommend picking up our printed schedules, which are kind of strewn about all over the city. There are plenty of great, interesting films as usual at this year's 35th PIFF, but any festival is wrought with challenges. But fear not, dear listener, Adjust Your Tracking is there for you. We'll talk about the films that have nabbed our attention, give you some recommendations, and discuss some films Joe and I wish were coming to the fest, but aren't. But first, we drop you back into the black hole of film discussion as Joe and I, gasp, disagree over two films currently in theaters. Steven Soderbergh's female spy fights men flick Haywire, and the Liam Neeson fights wolves survivalist horror film The Grey, a film chock full of scenes where Oscar Schindler himself says stuff like,
"Nobody's gonna find us if we don't move. We're all fucked."
And,
"You fuck with us, we fuck with you."
But now I hand it over to Joe as he eloquently kicks things off by pitting these two films together in battle.
I feel like our two movies that we're going to be discussing are going to fight with each other because one was I watched on your recommendation, didn't care for it. And the other one you watched on my recommendation, you're probably going to see it anyway.
Yes.
And you didn't care for it.
Well, you know a little bit. Okay, you read...
So the first film we'll discuss is Steven Soderbergh's Haywire, which is a vehicle for, what's her name?
Gina Carano. She's an MMA fighter, professional.
So she plays a government agent, a contracted government agent. What she does?
More like a Blackwater type, yeah.
And she gets double-crossed, and she wants revenge. And it's another genre exercise for Steven Soderbergh. And Eric, tell me how you felt about it.
I'm not going to say I love this or argue it as great cinema, but I think for the kind of movie it is, and to me it's just a down and dirty, quick in and out genre picture, a spy movie, sort of a spy movie on the run type of picture, and really it's a fight movie too. Casting Carano was what she lacks in personality or screen charisma, which is something I'm pretty sure you have an issue with. She makes up for in the fight scenes, and to me, the best way to place this as far as Soderbergh's films is it's kind of a cross between the low budget weird stuff he does like Girlfriend Experience,
right,
and something like the Ocean's movies. It's because it's more of a popular entertainment, but done in the style of something like the Girlfriend Experience.
Yeah, it's a little like lower grade, and totally. Like you said, down and dirty, but it's a little more plot heavy. I didn't like it.
You didn't like it?
No.
Okay.
I sort of edge on hating it at times when thinking about it, because to me the movie, I appreciate his attempts at taking on different genres, but I think his stamp on this movie really killed the momentum, which was crucial for any of the action sequences to work. Like, momentum is so key, because even if you don't care for the star who reminded me of a female Steven Seagal, who himself is like charismaless, kind of.
Totally, totally.
What he lacks in charisma, he makes up for in brutality.
Yes.
So I thought when the movie should have come to life in the fight sequences looked overly choreographed and everything just sort of plodded along, and his lack of chronological ordering didn't offer anything like surprising. Mm-hmm. It was just sort of, it just killed the momentum for me. And there was a lot of confusing casting, a lot of miscasting, I feel.
Who do you think was miscast?
I feel like Ewan McGregor was miscast.
Interesting. He's one of my favorite performances in the movie.
Well, me too. Okay. But he was, like, I was rooting for him in the final fight sequence.
Interesting.
It's like, if you pit female Steven Seagal against Ewan McGregor, you're just, like, beating up a puppy, essentially. Like, he's adorable. I don't
but
want
he's not.
Him.
He's a vicious little son of a bitch in this movie. And
he also has the best line
yes,
of the
does.
Film.
What, how does it go? You should not think of her as a woman.
Oh, you shouldn't think of her as a woman. That would be a mistake.
That is a great line. And he says it to Fassbender, Michael Fassbender, who I love his little bit role in this.
Right. Well, there's a lot of great stars in it. But
Michael Douglas.
It ends up being confusing because it's like stars attracted to a script that's not very good as a vehicle for an actress who's not very strong. So it's just, it's like, why is this movie happening?
I feel like pitting those movie stars against, countering against Carano, you know, I'm pretty sure it's her first time acting. You can tell for sure. She definitely has a rough time just reading lines occasionally. And actually, that's where the girlfriend experience comparison really falls in, because that movie casts Sasha Grey, a real life porn star.
They should do a buddy movie.
They should do the buddy movie. Seeing them two fight might be interesting too. But anyway, she's really stiff in her line readings in that movie. And I feel like it worked. The effect actually worked in a similar way, where you're supposed to feel that she's this numb character who really isn't interested in anything else. And this is the girlfriend experience.
Right.
She's not interested in anything else but the work. And Soderbergh's become really fascinated with like process and work in his films of late.
Yeah.
And Haywire's no different, where the character is just kind of, she's a professional through and through, so she's not going to be that charismatic. Mm-hmm. She just kind of has to look hot and kick ass, and I really feel like she was more than up for the challenge with that and accomplished it. And I have to disagree with the overly choreographed fight scenes that you said, because I can see a little bit of what you're saying, but I also felt the fight scenes had a rough and tumble kind of like, I felt the punches like I did with Kill. I thought of the first scene in Kill Bill Volume 1 where Uma fights Vivica Fox in her house and glass is being broken. You're feeling every punch, wood's breaking over their backs. I felt like every fight in Haywire, especially the one between her and Fassbender in the hotel room.
That was the best one.
It was. And the end of it, the climax of that fight scene, that scene in particular,
it's great.
Was great.
And it's important that it's in the center of the movie, because that's sort of like what pulled me in. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I found my way back out of the movie and didn't care for it. But, I mean, it's a strong centerpiece fight sequence. I felt like the concluding fight sequence, spoiler, with Ewan McGregor is so, it's shot in such a distracting way. Like, he'll cut to an angle where the sun is in the face of the camera. And you're just like, what are you doing?
A lot of lens flares. You didn't like that? I kind of liked that. That's more into,
J.J. Abrams was ghost shooting the movie.
yeah, definitely. I don't know, but even more with the shooting, I like that he used, I believe he shot it in scope, and that gives him a lot of room in the frame to fit all the fight scenes. And there weren't a ton of cuts with the fight scenes, too, I liked.
Right.
And, you know, you said his style, the Soderbergh stamp in this film has distracted you, essentially.
For me, yeah.
I love that sort of jazzy, like, 60s feel
that you said. Jazzy, because like that's immediately what I thought of in like a sort of disgusted way. I was like, oh, the editing is so jazzy.
No, man, that's what I liked about it. So it's just really okay. It's a matter of taste and what we want it for. But there's another thing I have to ask you about, because when we initially, you told me you didn't enjoy the movie,
right?
You had mentioned, you said, Eric, you got to see it for free. I saw it at a press screening, and you mentioned that you paid like $20 for you and someone else.
Yeah.
So I want to know what you mean by that. Like, are you saying that I might have been more forgiving because I saw it for free?
I mean, that's a cheap shot. That's like it's sort of, it's undermining your critical capacity. And so that was me feeling defensive and not really getting into the meat of the argument.
You cut me deep.
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I
pulled some Steven Seagal moves on you.
But did you feel cheated in the sense that you felt like you didn't get your $10 worth?
I knew that I didn't like the movie 10 minutes into
really?
It. Okay. I was in it for the opening scene with
Channing Tatum,
who I like, weirdly.
I
don't know why.
He's going to be working with Soderbergh a lot, too. They got a stripper movie coming out next year.
Outstanding.
Yeah, I need to see that.
And I even think the opening diner fight sequence between Gina and Channing Tatum is, like, I think that is overly choreographed, but I was willing to go with it. And then once it gets into, you know, the meat of the story.
The structure of everything. Yeah,
I was just like, no, sorry. I'm not with it. And I fought to get back in, and it didn't pay off for me.
Fair enough. I do like this as another collaboration between Soderbergh and screenwriter Lem Dobbs. He wrote the film The Limey.
Right.
And they, you know, mess with the flashback structure, the non-chronological order.
Well, I think that worked for The Limey.
You think so?
Really well.
I will agree it worked better for The Limey, and that's a better movie overall. But the way the structure of this movie, it's actually organic to the way the story is being told. Like, she gets in a fight with Channing Tatum in the beginning, takes a guy in his car, played by Michael Angarano, that young actor.
From Snow Angels.
Snow Angels, yep. And he's a really good, solid actor. And she's basically telling him, instead of giving us a voiceover, like, explaining, you know, how she got to this point, it's we're seeing the flashbacks through the way she's telling it.
Can you imagine that voiceover? Oh, my God.
It'd be horrible. Exactly. So I liked the way that they used that, you know, organic flashback structure.
I just wish Steven Seagal had narrated the whole movie.
That would have been awesome. Just Seagal.
Hoarse whispering. Like,
opening credit is just narrated by Steven Seagal.
I want to break someone's arm.
Oh, great. That'd be awesome. Well, okay, so we disagree on that one, and maybe we should move on to The Gray, another... and before we even get into The Gray, I think we need to say it's at least we're seeing a couple films in January, like major releases.
That are strong contenders.
Yeah, like worth discussing. I mean, my God, that's a rarity in itself.
It is. And I guess in closing, before we get into The Gray, about mm-hmm. Haywire, something that softened me up in thinking about it after the fact was Steven Soderbergh is constantly working.
Yes.
And so he's always finding his way. And mm-hmm. that's what I really appreciate about him. And sometimes it works for me and sometimes it doesn't. Like, I feel like his film last year, Contagion, was a really, really strong film.
He
really sort of found his groove with it, to use a jazzy term.
And
this one didn't so much work, but I just appreciate that he's constantly finding his way with different types of films all the time.
Totally. And I hope he doesn't retire. He keeps threatening retirement after, like, the next three films that he's going to shoot in a year, you know. But I agree. Like I said, I'm not going to argue that Haywire is great cinema, but for what it is, I think it's really, really solid. It's not up there with Contagion if we're going to compare it to his last film, but, you know, it is what it is.
Uh-oh. Okay. So next is... The Gray.
The Gray.
With Liam Neeson.
Yes.
Takes place in...
I want to say it's Alaska.
Yeah, because they mentioned Anchorage. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it's about a group of men on a drilling outpost who, on their way back to civilization, crash land in the mountains and have to fend for themselves and survive. And it's strange because, like, within the first 10 minutes of this film, I knew that I loved it.
Okay.
Like, the atmosphere... There's a scene where Liam Neeson walks into the company bar.
Yes.
And there's just like, there are things in the film that could easily feel contrived, but there's a level of commitment that just rules out all contrivance for me.
Mm-hmm.
So
commitment from the actors and everybody involved.
Yeah, and the direction, I feel.
By Joe Carnahan.
Yes.
Carnahan, I'm sorry.
Of A-Team fame. And Narc.
Narc, which I'm a fan of, and we'll get into that a little bit more. But
And, the movie was dire to the point of being nearly existential. Not even nearly. The movie was existential.
Totally.
And the survivors are a cast of people who are definitely archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, there's a pleasure of watching these archetypes interact.
Mm-hmm.
And... it was so atmospheric and genuinely terrifying and funny in parts that I found myself to be the only person laughing a lot of the times.
Yeah, that happened to me in my theater experience too.
Yeah.
I was laughing at Neeson a lot. Like,
there's just a lot of like humor and there's a lot of humor just written into the dialogue.
Totally.
And I think the movie, for a mainstream film that was the number one movie in the country this last weekend.
Hell yes.
It is a dark, relentless film for a mainstream film.
And I do love it for that, but I'm going to start with one of my issues comes from the very scene that you were talking about, that bar scene, okay?
Okay.
So before he walks into this bar and we're introduced to sort of everybody else that's in this lonely, you know, like you said, atmospheric, you feel cold watching this
right.
movie. That's great, right? And you get a voiceover where Neeson is sort of explaining a past love that he had. You're just learning enough about his character to go into it, right?
Yeah.
I'm loving that. You're seeing him walking around with his rifle, and he hunts wolves. He's the guy that keeps the wolves from attacking the oil workers. He's like in an oil drill plant or something like that.
Exactly.
Right? So he's this badass like hunter, and he's this lonely kind of warrior type. And as soon as he walks in, and I'm just loving this movie. I am sucked in already at this point.
Minute two, maybe.
It's not even that soon. But I love, even before that, I love opening credits, the gray, boom, you're right into the story.
Yeah.
None of the other credits are necessary. So it's kind of like Michael Mann has done that recently with like Miami Vice. You just started right into the story. Mm-hmm. Very cool. I'm dropped in there. Neeson's walking along. I'm loving it. He goes into this bar. And you said that it wasn't contrived, but I feel like that suddenly it was like the bar from
the fight sequence.
It was like from Roadhouse or something. And I'm like, this is what Joe loves about this movie.
I love Roadhouse.
I know. And I'm like, okay. It didn't. That was just a minor thing where I'm like, it was taking itself so seriously. And suddenly I felt like there was this ridiculous cliched bar fight scene. And it's like,
yeah.
Okay, there are a bunch of rowdy guys. That might actually happen in this environment. I'm fine.
Yeah.
So that's just the first little inkling of like, ooh, this like maybe a little bit of unevenness in the movie. But then you have a good 30 or 40 minutes of just incredible filmmaking. That plane crash is amazing.
Yeah.
In that movie.
It's one of the greater plane crashes.
Oh, my God. I was, I actually have a fondness for the movie Alive from the early 90s.
Which it recalls, like, a lot.
Big time, big time.
In fact, makes direct reference to it.
They reference it.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I really liked that. And that plane crash in that movie is just brutal and hard to watch.
But still.
Yes, it is. You're seeing people get sucked out of the back of an open airplane. That's creepy. But in this movie, it's the camera's locked in on Neeson.
Yeah.
And when it splits apart, like just those visuals were amazing. Loved the claustrophobic feel of this movie, the way it's shot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the plane crashes, and then it's suddenly Neeson is the man in charge, or he's going to put himself in charge because he seems best to be able to help him and the survivors.
Right.
Then the movie takes an interesting turn into like horror territory, wouldn't you say?
A little bit, like Jaws, survivals, just man versus nature.
That's a good comparison. Or The Edge to another survivalist movie they encounter, Bear in this. Here it's a bunch of wolves. And I love the sort of mythic, almost like Hemingway aspect of this movie where it's like men being men.
Yeah.
And that stuff is great. But then there's just, I don't know, I feel like the movie can't decide what it wants to be. Does it want to be take itself seriously to the point? Does Carnahan? I feel like he's taking himself very seriously, and he wants this to reach a level of like existential, he's pondering existential things that are going on for someone trying to survive this moment. But I feel in the midst of that, he draws the movie out too long. It's about 2 hours long, and if I'm going to compare directly to Haywire, the only thing I would say is Haywire was under 90 minutes and knew when to cut off the movie and end at the right point.
That's true.
I feel like The Gray, I take huge issue with the ending of this movie.
Okay, which is interesting because both of these films take out the final conflict.
Yes, they do. Yes, they do. And it worked so much better in Haywire for me because there's a line that comes that was like a pitch-perfect reading by Antonio Banderas. But for The Gray, I feel like I was totally cheated of the thing I was going in to see this movie. The reason I wanted to see it.
I feel like the conceit of the film is completed in that last moment.
Yep.
It's hilarious. The person in front of me, throughout, like the minute the screen went black, he said, "Gay."
Oh,
and I
God.
Was like, his friend turned to him and immediately told him to shut the fuck up.
That's good.
It was an interesting sort of conflict of an audience.
Totally. And that was similar to my audience. Like, people, there was a lot of what? Like, like they were not prepared for that to be the end. I wouldn't go that far. I didn't feel cheated in that sense. Or it wasn't like my reaction was like, what the hell? Maybe it's the way the movie's been marketed. If you watch the trailer, they're hinting at something that's going to come. Mainly, Liam Neeson's going to fight some fucking wolves.
Yeah.
And you're kind of cheated of that moment.
It's true. They build that moment. And I don't know. Can we discuss it without?
I think we should. It's too soon that the movie's been out. I don't think we should get into direct details. But we can say that it's like, I feel like what we're saying is okay. You know?
Okay.
Like, things were cheated. I felt cheated in that sense. And I guess my main, you're right. A certain arc is completed with the way the movie ends.
Yeah.
I feel like Carnahan could have cut 15 minutes out, and there's specific scenes that could have been taken right out, I think.
It's true.
That would have shortened the movie up, made it a little tighter, and it could have reached a level of artistic quality that it didn't need to be forced. I feel like he was forcing this stuff. And it has to do with this poem that Neeson recites from his father.
Yeah, and the poem is introduced in a series of flashbacks, which was the only problem I had with the movie.
Yep. That first scene around the campfire or whatever.
It took you out of the world of the film.
Totally.
Which is the only time it does that.
Yes.
Because you're immersed in this world.
Yep.
And
the immediacy is kind of taken away from you.
Yeah, exactly. And you have like a, maybe the relief is necessary almost to just have this like sort of sunny memory, but not really.
Isn't it enough that they're sitting around the fire and they have a moment of calm in the midst of all this, just, it's terror. Like these wolves are freaking hunting these guys down.
Yeah.
And they're doing okay, but not so good. And it's like, they have a moment to sit around and talk. And I feel like when Neeson... One guy talks about
there's
a couple,
humor in that
there
scene.
There is. There's humor,
like,
right?
And then suddenly
it's like the air is sucked out of that room, even though there is no room. It's like the air is sucked out of the room when Neeson recites this memory of his father. And I felt like you can see the reactions of the actors. It's almost like they don't know what to say after that. And it's like maybe you wouldn't, but it's like that just felt like a dead moment. But that's not as bad as there's like a minute-long scene where, I'll just say, there's only a couple people left at this point in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's just Neeson and one other guy. And the guy tells him that it's revealed in the beginning of the movie, so this isn't a spoiler, that Neeson is suicidal. He almost kills himself in the beginning of the movie.
Right.
And I feel like there is a forced scene, this is the worst part in the movie for me, where a character tells him that he knew that he tried to do that.
Yeah.
And then Neeson goes, well, he basically says the reason, I think, for cutting this scene out of the movie. He goes, well, that doesn't really matter anymore now. And the guy goes, I guess you're right. And it's like, why did we just spend 5 minutes...
Yeah.
Telling it to me, it felt like the director didn't have faith in the audience to remember that moment in the beginning of the
movie.
So it's
absolutely.
Like, remember? Neeson tried to kill himself.
But with all the bravery that's required for such a dark film, mm-hmm. I'm willing to forgive the flashback and I'm willing to forgive a totally unnecessary scene. Because there are just other just wholly grim and fatalistic moments.
There it is.
And like
when people die in this movie, oh my God.
It's not nice.
It's not nice. And that's as it should be. That after the first character that dies post plane crash,
that scene is riveting.
I was like choked up and I didn't even know who this character was.
Right.
Like, that's powerful, good stuff.
Yeah.
Really good stuff. I wish there was more of it though. Like, well, no, there was a lot of it, but I hated being taken out of those moments.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still going to say that I think The Gray is good and I recommend people go see it.
Me too.
But I think it's so close. What frustrates me more, it's probably more of an accomplishment than Haywire, I'll be honest. But what frustrates me more with The Gray is that it could have been great.
For you.
Yeah, it could have been great for me.
Yeah.
And it fell short because it felt like either the studio maybe didn't have faith in him to give the story. Who knows?
What they did have faith in is still a remarkable achievement that it got into theaters. And that who knows what's going to happen after this weekend with word of mouth circulating.
Yeah.
But, you know.
It'll be a mixed thing, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Like you said, like your theater experience.
Yeah.
Definitely. And, you know, it's just good to see Carnahan go back because this movie feels big, but like probably a small crew because they shot it on location, I think.
Yeah.
And it looks amazing.
It does.
His balance of claustrophobic tight shots to wide, like,
just
overheads, wide, you know.
Just swallowing them into the landscape.
The snow is like inhaling these guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
That stuff is really, really good. And it's good. I know you're not as big a fan as Narc, Carnahan's second film, as I am, but it felt like kind of a return to that sort
it's
of.
Closer tonally than his other films,
yeah.
I think.
And I haven't even seen Smoking Aces or The A-Team. I just have no interest in that stuff.
Me neither. Sorry, Joe.
Sorry, man. But, I'm cool with The Gray. I just think it could have been so much better. It was so close to being great.
Yeah, I understand what you mean.
Okay, but you think I'm wrong?
No, I don't. I understand your issues. They didn't affect me in the same way.
You were more forgiving of it. And maybe, I know I'm going to watch that movie again. Maybe both movies that we've reviewed here. So maybe my opinion will change. But for now we disagree, my friend.
Yes, finally.
Finally, yes. Hopefully more to come here and there.
Everybody be cool.
All right, so with the Oscar nominations come in, what was it, last week, I believe?
Yes.
So we felt this is a good time as any to just discuss our thoughts on the nominations, maybe who we thought was snubbed, some surprises that got in there, what we don't agree on the Academy with, And also just, we can also maybe do a little prediction at the end of who we think will win and who we wish would have been nominated sort of thing.
Yes.
So let's start. We're going to go to the kind of keep it to the major categories we decided. And we're going to start with why don't we start with the supporting categories, the supporting actor.
Okay.
Joe, are there any that stand from either the actress or the actor that were just good, I guess, surprises in a good way for you? Let's start there.
I'd say Melissa McCarthy for Bridesmaids is a pleasant surprise because there was, I think, early buzz that that movie was going to get some Oscar attention just because the quality of it and that it was such a smash success and they seemed to be wanting to appeal to, the popular audience with their choices.
Definitely.
And she was definitely runaway, hit from that movie.
She was great in it, yeah. And it's kind of nice to see the script was nominated too for Bridesmaids. So
yeah.
Kristen Wiig got her due there for that. And I did enjoy Bridesmaids. That was cool to see for sure. I'd say the one thing I maybe disagree with in supporting actress is Jessica. I haven't seen The Help. Apparently, a lot of people love that movie, but
yeah.
Jessica Chastain was nominated for that. So I guess I don't know how good she is in it, but I would have loved to see her nominated for Take Shelter, her role in Take Shelter as the wife.
She's outstanding in that.
Yeah, she's fantastic. So I guess I just disagree with the movie, but I can't totally say it because I haven't seen The Help. So
I wonder if because she is the female lead in Take Shelter, if that would have qualified her for Best Actress.
Yeah.
And that category was just too crowded, possibly.
Probably. That's probably the case, for sure. And then I would say one person I felt that was snubbed in the supporting actress was she played George Clooney's daughter in The Descendants, Shailene Woodley, the oldest daughter that he has. I actually thought she was fantastic in that movie, and I would have liked to have seen her nominated, but they overlooked her for that. But
yeah, I was pretty struck by her, too.
Yeah.
It made me look up her IMDb page.
Totally, totally. You know a movie's had an effect if that happens, so. But what about the actor category? There's a couple interesting ones in there. Jonah Hill, Moneyball?
Which I think is great.
I think it's great that he's nominated, but
I think
that means that Albert Brooks didn't get nominated for Drive.
Well, I mean, come on. There are some other people that could be bumped out.
I know, Max von Sydow for Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
Which, we'll get to that movie's involvement in other categories.
Yes, we will.
In addition to this one, but I've never seen a movie nominated multiple times that's been so universally panned by everybody? Like, is it just because it's a September 11th movie that it immediately gets inducted? They didn't do the same with World Trade Center, guys.
They did not. And I think the main thing that's it's a trend that you can't ignore is the director who made Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, Stephen Daldry.
Mm-hmm.
He's made four films. They've all been nominated for Best Picture. The Reader was the last one, the one where Kate Winslet won Best Actor. That movie, he got a director nomination for that, too. That movie was panned more than it was, revered, just like Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. So it's
anyone revere it, though.
I know. It's weird. It's weird. And then he made Billy Elliot before that and The Hours. All of his films have been nominated for Best Picture. He's been nominated for director three times until this time. So
what is going on?
What is it with Daldry? Do they just like the Academy loves him. So that's weird, but I can't even comment. Neither one of us can. We haven't actually seen that film. So
yeah, it's not fair. And Max von Sydow gets the, sort of he's the elder. And
yeah.
So he gets in there. I would bump you out to make room for Albert Brooks from Drive, though.
What about John Hawks from Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene?
I thought you might bring him up.
I think he belongs in there.
Did he win last year for?
He was nominated for supporting
Winner's Bone.
Yeah, didn't win.
It's too eerily close.
I know, but it's a better performance.
It is, but it's political, so
it is. Like, you're right.
We already nominated.
Realistic.
A backwoods creep, like we can't nominate him twice for the same role, essentially.
You're right. And I'm happy to see Jonah Hill get nominated because we've said before, like his chemistry with Pitt, like they were both great in that movie.
Yeah. Of the two, between Christopher Plummer, who I thought was amazing in Beginners, and Nick Nolte, who is heartbreaking in Warrior.
Oh, he's grizzled. He's so grizzled in that movie.
He's amazing.
Oh, he's
so meek in the beginning of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And without doing anything, you can sense this dormant anger,
yep.
This fury inside of him, with it, like him doing very little. Like
yep.
It's such a nuanced performance that gets volcanic eventually.
Yep.
So between the two, which I think there's a good chance Christopher Plummer might take it because of his Golden Globe win. And I think he definitely deserves it, but I'm definitely torn between the two.
I think Plummer's a lock.
Okay.
For sure. I think he's won everything up to this point. And it's one of, not only is it a great performance, but it's the thing the Oscars love. It's a, they can reward him for his whole career by giving him an Oscar now, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's deserved.
Totally deserved, because actually the performance is, would probably win no matter, you know, no matter what. Like,
yeah.
The performance is there. All right. So then let's move on to the, how about Best Actress?
Best Actress.
My surprise here is, pleasant surprise, I will say, is Rooney Mara for The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
For
and
sure.
I'm really glad she got nominated, because there's a lot of pressure for a young actress for this role. It was one that a lot of the top actresses, young actresses, were vying for.
Yeah.
And she got it on the faith of David Fincher, because he loved her, you know, 10 minutes of screen time in The Social Network.
Which she's great in.
Yeah, she made an impression, especially in that opening scene of The Social Network.
Yeah.
And she is fantastic in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. And I do feel, while Daniel Craig's not, he didn't get any love for his role in that movie, and he was really solid, it's her movie. And she was. It was great to see her nominated for that. So that was a pleasant surprise. I didn't necessarily think she would get nominated for that movie. So.
Yeah, it is one of the surprises of the category. I'm upset that Tilda Swinton didn't make it in.
It's ridiculous.
We need to talk about Kevin, Charlize Theron from Young Adult.
That's ridiculous.
And I think they're two problematic characters that the Academy maybe just has a hard time swallowing.
I think if you look at the Academy's made up mostly of older members, like they're people that are retired. And if you look at the type of movies that tend to win Oscars, or actors and roles that win Oscars, it's not as complicated as something like Young Adult or We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Yeah.
And I'm just surprised more so with Charlize Theron not getting nominated. We Need to Talk About Kevin's maybe a little too obtuse for some, you know, some people, and maybe it's not on everybody's radar like
it's
it is
true.
Ours. But Young Adult was a Jason Reitman film, and it was not released in December. Maybe it got buried by all the other movies that came out in December, too.
I feel like it did.
Yeah.
I feel like box office-wise it got buried, and I feel like critically it also got buried, even though I feel like it was revered.
Yeah, it was.
It got shuffled out, and, you know, not to forget Patton Oswalt, who could have been another, you know, contender for Best Supporting Actor.
That's true. I mean, so the rest of the actual Best Actress nominees kind of bore me. And they're actually in four movies that I have not seen. So Glenn Close and Albert Nobbs, Viola Davis, The Help, Meryl Streep, The Iron Lady, and Michelle Williams, My Week with Marilyn.
Honestly, I had never heard of Albert Nobbs before these nominations were released.
It's been on my radar since Toronto in September last year, but yeah, it's not even out in Portland yet.
It just opened.
Oh, it did
Friday.
Just open. Okay. Yeah. That shows how interested I am in that movie. Those just seem like more typical Oscar nominations.
Well, and
roles.
The Iron Lady has been getting really,
really
poor
bad
reviews.
It's just that Meryl Streep, it's like they feel the need to nominate her just every year.
I mean, who doesn't love Meryl Streep?
She's great, but it's boring.
Yeah.
I could replace those four, having not seen the movies, with Elizabeth Olsen, Martha Marcy Marlene, my favorite performance, female performance of the year, Kirsten Dunst from Melancholia, Charlize Theron, and what was the other one?
Tilda Swinton.
And Tilda Swinton. I would love those five if you tacked on Rooney Mara still with them. That would be really satisfying to me.
Yeah, it would be the underclassmen.
It would be the B squad. So, okay, let's move on to Best Actor then. The surprise here for me is Damien Bashir, in a film I barely know anything about, A Better Life.
Is it the only nomination for that film?
Yes, it is. And then not surprised to see Clooney for The Descendants, Jean D'Argent for The Artist, and Brad Pitt from Moneyball, and Gary Oldman. Love seeing him get nominated for Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. So
would he be your pick?
He would be my pick out of these five. I don't think it'll happen. I think it's between Clooney and the actor for The Artist. Because those seem to be the two big movies.
Is Gary Oldman not at the point in his career where he could get a career award?
It could happen. That would be great.
That would be great.
I would love to see that. And if not Oldman, I would go Brad Pitt over the rest of the others. For me, Clooney, George Clooney's good in The Descendants, but I actually feel like he's the weak spot in that movie. I've told you before, like, I have issues with some just buying his role. He's George freaking Clooney, and he's playing a cuckolded husband in this movie.
Right.
And I'm cool with The Descendants. It's a good, solid movie, but I feel like he's the weak spot in it. It's hard to wrap your brain around
You don't believe he's a dad.
I don't believe that he's the loser, the sort of, not loser, the guy that could be taken advantage of like he is in this movie.
Yeah.
It's not that he's bad. It's that I felt like some things were forced. There's a scene where he runs very specifically. This scene takes me right out of the movie where
Eric hates
like,
this.
I do hate that scene. It's like he's, I can see the acting. It's like his idea of what that
a
kind
schlubby
of.
Schlubby husband.
Yeah,
would look
how
like.
He would run, and it feels very forced. And scenes like that in The Descendants take me out of his performance. And it's unfortunate. It's like it's between him and I think this guy in the for the artist. I would go with, like I said, Oldman would be awesome. Not without that, Pitt and Moneyball. I'd
right.
go with it.
Snubs.
Yeah, I have several. We brought up our actress ones. Michael Fassbender wasn't nominated for
yeah.
Shame. That's my favorite performance of the year. Number one.
I feel like the Academy hates Shame.
I think you're right. I don't think it was nominated at all.
No.
Nothing.
It didn't even get the courtesy drive nomination.
best
sound editing.
Oh, man.
I would say Michael Shannon for Take Shelter.
You got it. That was my other one. Yeah.
Yeah. He, like, just such a devastating performance. And
yeah.
it was one that you could have easily seen how it could have gone based on his previous performances.
Right.
Just a haunted character, but he brings so much more life to it.
Totally. Totally. It's a shame. It's a shame. I would have loved to have seen those two in there.
Why did you diss the Michaels
Academy? That ain't cool, man. That ain't cool. All right, so best director. This category is kind of driving me crazy right now. Like
okay.
This is the one that frustrates me the most. So you've got Michael Hazanavicius from The Artist.
Yes.
Everybody loves that movie. Alexander Payne for The Descendants. Martin Scorsese for Hugo, Woody Allen for Midnight in Paris, and your boy Terrence Malick for
The Tree of Life.
Holy shit.
T-T-O-L.
So I'm going to start off by saying even the most egregious here is Woody Allen for Midnight in Paris. Like, fun movie, very nice movie.
Pleasant,
right? But Woody Allen, best director? Like, you're forgetting, we did just mention how Shame is apparently hated by the Academy. Steve McQueen not being nominated, ridiculous. I know it's not typical, but... typical Oscar movie, but Nicholas Winding Refn for Drive not being nominated is...
Well, just the fact that he won Best Director at Cannes.
Yeah.
Know? Like, that I think that's a testament to his abilities, and even if it wasn't liked by the Academy, the film itself,
yeah.
You have to acknowledge that it's a vision
yeah.
of a true director.
I agree. I totally agree, and I guess maybe that's more... That's its prize. It's more appropriate that it would be at Cannes, you know, that he won for that.
Yeah.
Because maybe it's more of a Cannes film than an Oscar film. It must be, obviously, but I need to know your thoughts on Terrence Malick as Best Director, and before you get into it,
mm-hmm.
some friends of mine, film journalists, think Malick is going to win Director this year. They're like, it's going to win, and The Artist will win Best Picture. That's their argument.
It's
going to happen.
I think that's a fair assessment, and I think that, you know, in addition to the actors and actresses we commented on as winning for, like, a career award,
mm-hmm.
I feel like Terrence Malick might win because Martin Scorsese has already won for... The Departed.
Yep.
And
Woody Allen's won before.
Yeah. Best Director?
Yeah, for Annie Hall.
Oh, see, that's deserved.
It totally deserved, exactly, yeah.
But I feel like Terrence Malick, even though The Tree of Life, I definitely don't think is his strongest film, I think this could be a career achievement award.
And, you know, in that sense, it wouldn't anger me, because I like most of his movies.
Yeah.
I do. His first three films, I love. But yeah, it just doesn't seem like it would be for the right movie. There's moments of Tree of Life where I'd say like, yeah, he's the best director, but not the entire film. It's not the entire running.
Well, there are moments that cancel those moments out for
absolutely, me. Absolutely. Like blaring like 20-minute segments where I'm like, I can't get behind these elements, and I don't get, he's going to win. I think it's inevitable that he's going to win, but maybe out of those fives, who would just the five that were required, that were nominated, if we had to pick, who would you like, or who do you think?
Oh, boy. That's rough, because I genuinely disliked The Tree of Life.
Yep.
So to give it to Malick, even though I think he is an amazing auteur,
mm-hmm.
would be hard for me.
Yep.
It would be a pain in my side. So I don't, out of the directors, I don't know. Let me hear your choice.
I'm going to say, because I've seen all five films that are nominated for Best Director, and I'm going to say, out of those five, I think Scorsese deserves it for Hugo.
Really?
And he won't get it. Like you said, they finally rewarded him for The Departed, but he's the most deserving of those five. But it's probably going to go to Malick. If not him, bet on the artist director, Michel Hazanavicius. I think I pronounced that right. You avoided that at all costs. You were smarter than me. But
so I don't want to back out of making a choice. Mm-hmm. I feel I can't give it to Terrence Malick.
No,
I can't.
No. Can't do
so,
it.
let's reward. You know what? You robbed Martin Scorsese of so many previous films.
Yeah.
Give it to him for Hugo.
Give him the second Oscar. That'd be Spielberg's won two directing Oscars. Why can't Scorsese?
Give it to him.
And to be honest, Hugo needs some love. That movie's kind of been a financial disaster because it was really expensive to make.
Yeah.
And it hasn't caught on like I think it should have. You haven't seen it yet, have you?
I haven't.
It's a magical movie, man. It's great. And it just narrowly missed my top 10. And I kind of wish I would have put it on there now, but regardless, it's probably my number 11 of the year of last year. And I love that movie. It's a movie for cinephiles. And
but, I would love to see just him get excited again.
I
just
know.
That little man on stage.
That'd be great. That'd be great.
I made the mistake of directing my eyes towards the best picture category, and it sort of sunk me all of a sudden.
Yeah, the picks for the 9. Best picture picks this year.
None of them I'm really excited about. We mentioned Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, the most panned movie of all of them.
I know.
Somehow eking its way into the category.
Daldry's like in with the Academy or something. I don't know what it is. And it's probably the fact that it was a bestseller based off a bestseller book. It has 9/11 elements to it. Who knows?
So we've got War Horse, The Artist, Moneyball, The Descendants, TTOL, The Tree of Life, Midnight in Paris, The Help, Hugo, and like we said, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close.
The worst film that I've seen on this list is War Horse. The movie's almost terrible.
Yeah.
It's the worst elements of saccharine, like Spielberg sentiment that he... There are some amazing technical cinematography things in the film, but... Oh God! Like that movie just kind of drove me nuts, and I hated it the more as the movie went on. Like it progressively got worse.
Yeah.
So that I can't believe was nominated because that isn't necessarily like winning audiences and critics over 100% either, which is strange. It feels like another kind of token nomination.
Yeah, it seems like they're just filing certain movies in.
Yeah.
Like, go ahead, go right in.
Oh, Streep made a movie. She's nominated for actress. Oh, Spielberg made a movie. Throw him in there. Daldry.
Love you guys. Yeah. Come on in.
I don't get that at all. The Artist seems like the one that's going to be the big winner.
Yeah.
By all accounts.
People love it.
Moneyball, we're both big fans of. I would actually go, if I had to choose out of these 9 nominees, I would say I'd love to see Hugo take it out of those 9.
Right.
Hugo, because I think it's the best out of them. And then Moneyball, if not Hugo.
And I would say Moneyball.
Yeah, and I don't think either one has a chance.
No. I don't know what does. I mean, I'm concerned that The Help might win to win the sort of driving Miss Daisy vote.
Oh, man.
Which beat out Do the Right Thing, which I don't even think was nominated for Best Picture
in
89.
It wasn't. That's ridiculous.
Yeah. Let's get mad. So what do we feel got snubbed?
For Best Picture, I don't really have anything that comes to mind. Well, yeah, I do. I would have loved to have seen something. I'm trying to be realistic, though. Like,
yeah.
What I... Realistic about something that had a chance to be nominated.
Yeah.
And in that case, I'm trying to think, like, what's the most mainstream thing that I picked that seems Oscar-y? I don't know. Because I would immediately say Drive, and I actually thought Drive had an inkling of a chance just because it's an L.A. movie, and maybe, like, Hollywood people would have grasped onto that, but I'm not surprised that it didn't get nominated for Best Picture, so I can't quite say that. So,
it got nominated, like we said before, for Best Sound Effects Editing, which is what Fight Club got nominated for the year it came out, which I was hopeful that it would get, you know, just a huge amount of nominations.
Yeah.
No.
Not at all. It's the
no
token.
Way.
So I guess I'm kind of at a loss because if I'm thinking about my top 10, there's nothing.
Realistically.
Yeah, yeah. Hugo probably is the one I'm glad to get nominated because that would have been number 11 on my list.
And Moneyball is the only one that was on my list that's nominated.
So you got to go with that. Yeah, I don't know. And what I think is going to win is probably The Artist, I think. And you haven't seen that either, have you?
Not yet.
That movie is sweet. It's good. It's kind of like... in a way, like Midnight in Paris, it's a nice, sweet movie that
perfectly
reminds me
pleasant.
Of everything. Yeah, but doesn't inspire fervent love for the movie for me. I don't want to watch it again. I feel like I've seen it already. You know, it's done.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to say something that I wish would have, you know, something that was snubbed specifically. You know, it's like you can go back to our top tens from two episodes ago and you would get the idea of what we would have picked.
Right. I think it's just hard to get excited about this category at all.
I agree. And then lastly, I just want to put just a few things that were pleasant. Best foreign language film. This film Bullhead was nominated. I've seen it. I saw it at the end of last year. It's fantastic. It's playing at PIFF coming up next week. Starting February 9th, PIFF starts, and there are schedules out there. You can go to nwfilm.org to look at all the films that we have. Bullhead is one worth checking out. A Separation, I think, is going to win Best Foreign Language Film. That's a solid film.
Yeah, a lot of heat on that movie.
There is. It's going to win, probably. And then in the animated category, Chico and Rita, we showed that at the Film Center, I believe, in December, at the end of November. I projected it, and it's a nice – I'm glad to see that one nominated. It's an adult animated movie. Really, really solid. And then A Cat in Paris will be showing at PIFF, actually, as well. It's another animated French film. Hand-drawn, classically animated film. So that sounds really solid. Look for that one. I haven't seen it personally yet, but, you know, it's coming out in PIFF. We're bringing it to Portland before the Oscars before the winners are announced. So,
okay.
Yeah, I think with that, that's about as far, you know, that's about as excited as me and Joe are going to get about the Oscars, because it just doesn't tend to be the movies that we get excited about.
No.
But damn it, we're going to pay attention every year, and it's going to frustrate us still. It's like we've said before, we want to see the stuff we care about get rewarded, you know?
I tried to think of the last time I was genuinely surprised by the Academy Awards. I think maybe 2002.
Yeah, when The Pianist.
When Michael Moore
said
Shame on You to the president.
Oh, actual show itself.
Yeah.
Totally.
When Eminem's intern accepted the award for best song.
Do you remember Barbara Streisand's reading of his name, too, when he won the Oscars? She was just disgusted that Eminem won. I was like, that was amazing.
Yes. Please, more disgusting of Barbra Streisand.
That would be great. And lastly, I'm just going to say that, you know, it's a bit of a shame that I feel like specifically the Best Picture nominees, it seems like it's leaning more towards the kind of conservative tendencies of the Academy.
Yeah.
And that comes off the heels of last year, the King's Speech kind of winning all the big awards. That felt like a return to the sort of more boring conservative picks for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of left in its wake the last few years before that. You had No Country for Old Men, The Departed winning Best Picture, both those films winning Best Picture.
Yeah.
The Hurt Locker, like difficult, complicated or complex films, that violent adult films. And it just seems like they're getting away from the more challenging stuff.
Yeah, they feel bad.
They do. It's like, well, we rewarded some of these weird, you know, more off the beaten path films, or just films that are not traditional Oscar movies.
Sorry you guys had to see those off our recommendation.
Yeah.
And then now they're like, watch these, you'll feel better.
Yeah, it's like they're on a completely different track than Adjust Your Tracking. So the Oscars, are, you know, we're not in keeping with their picks, but it is what it is. So.
That's twice
that's
for
the
it is
second
what it
time
is.
I've ended a segment.
Hashtag
with
that.
All right, hashtag them shits. All right, so we are returning back to Love It or Hate It. If you remember from episode 2, we explained the rules of the game, wherein Joe has two picks, one film that he loves, one that he hates. I would pick it and decide, I try to guess if he loves or hates the film. If you remember, I picked U-Turn, and I thought Joe loved it. He rebuked that and said, no, he hates this film. In fact, he's disgusted with it.
Yes.
And the result of that is that he had to revisit the film and come back and reevaluate for you, the listener, and for me. I'm just interested.
Yeah.
Joe Von Appen, what do you think of U-Turn in 2012?
Well, U-Turn had its work cut out for it because at this time of year, there's so many films that I either want to catch up on or I just flat out want to see.
Yes.
And so to have to mark out 2 hours. The movie's 2 hours.
It's tough.
Devoting it to a movie that I know that I hate.
Yeah.
What's the best possible outcome? That I could have been wrong.
Could have been
13
wrong.
Years ago. And it was actually, more than that, 15 years ago. And that it was actually good.
Mm.
And that this is a surprise now. And so I sat down to watch it. Opening shot. It's a wide shot of the desert, and a song that wouldn't be out of place on the Swinger soundtrack comes on. I'm like, you know what? Maybe I'll be nostalgic for what the 90s were nostalgic for, because it came out in 1997.
Yep.
Minute into it, nope, I hate this movie. Just immediately. Like, Oliver Stone won't leave the film alone.
Yep.
He changes film stock, he changes angles, and he is in a really bratty way obsessed with what's disgusting in this movie. And I tried to hang on to little things, like the town that the film is set in.
Mm-hmm.
looks like a sort of jaundiced William Eggleston picture wasn't enough.
No.
Because the movie is just like bent on repulsing you for no benefit. And
you still found nothing to latch on to at this
point. No, and it's childish.
It is.
And it's,
from what I
remember, attempts to shock you. There's an under the shot, there's a shot of John Voight looking up at him and he's drooling. It's like why?
Yeah.
What why is this necessary?
I only remember all the weird cutaways to like Billy Bob Thornton and his big gut, and like he's this mechanic who's just constantly dirty and filthy, and it's just like that's the movie itself to me in a nutshell. It's just dirty and gross and unnecessary.
Yeah, it seems like a really exhausted attempt to capitalize on the oddball nature of the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
Something like
interesting.
That.
Interesting.
And it just, it fucks it up so bad.
Without the, maybe he can't capture the tone that the Coen brothers so easily conjure.
No, because it comes effortlessly for them. And so him being as spastic as he is, he can't do it.
All right, well, not surprised. I'm glad I didn't have to rewatch U-Turn because I'm just going to keep it at that and trust your reevaluation there. And you're a brave man for watching it now twice. I think you can safely put a lid on it and say U-Turn is officially a bad movie in your opinion. Now, as far as for me, for Way of the Gun, I said I would revisit it, and I did. And I don't have much to say except I still really love this movie, except I'm going to reevaluate my kind of angle I went on with it last week. I kind of described it as the great post-Tarantino movie, and
right.
I feel like that still holds true for the most part, but actually it's almost unfair at this point to even label it as something like that because it is its own thing.
Right.
So elements of the characters and the dialogue ring in a Tarantino sort of way, but other than that, it even precedes some of the stuff that Tarantino later got into, the kind of Western elements that Tarantino put in Kill Bill Volume 2 specifically and in Glorious Bastards. Christopher McQuarrie, the writer-director of Way of the Gun, I feel like he was on that even before Tarantino. The movie I still love the gradual revealing of information, the way McQuarrie has faith in the audience to just trust that things that he's obscuring from your knowledge will get paid off later.
Yeah.
And they do. And the convoluted plot nicely kind of comes together. It's extremely violent, more violent than I remembered. You remember the scene, there's a shootout at the end in that Mexican villa where Ryan Phillippe jumps into a well?
Yeah, he just starts to scream.
Oh, and he has a huge shard of glass sticking out of his freaking arm, and that scene is so difficult to watch, but it's great. And I love that McQuarrie is willing to kind of rub a pretty boy like Phillippe, his face, just like get him down and dirty, and they're just bloody messes by the end of the movie. And Del Toro, there's little touches why I love him as an actor. Like, for instance, before that big gunfight at the end of the movie starts, they come in strapped with a bunch of guns, and they tell a bunch of what look like prostitutes hanging out at the bar. They're basically like, get the hell out of here. You know, shit's about to go down.
Oh, I know.
And as they run by, and Del Toro just gives, it must have been an improvise, just gives one of them a little bit of a slap on the butt, and it's like such a perfect little moment in that movie that also is a character moment, because what I really grasped this time is what sleazeballs these guys are. And it's not that they're the smartest criminals, and they both know that. They know that they're not going to have an opportunity for a big score in life unless they just kind of do it, is that they're the dirty fighters. Like, they're smart. It's not that they're dumb. It's not that they're geniuses. They're willing to do the thing that a more fair fighter would you know, do. They're more willing to get down and dirty and not play fair, which I like about their characters.
And there's a poetry not only to the dialogue of the whole film, but there's a poetry to the vulgarity of those two characters.
Definitely.
And it's just, there are plenty of films that we'll talk about that we're not going to care about the characters.
Yeah.
And this is a movie that on paper you shouldn't care about them because they're lowlifes.
Definitely.
But there's something compelling about them.
And also they have a redemptive moment. The end of the movie is basically them deciding morally to do the right thing, at least for the people that they've gotten to know in the story. And I forgot about that. I thought it was all about money. And in a way it is, but they do make a choice to help someone in this movie, and I appreciated that.
And you should too.
Yes, so that movie, I'd say, is still well worth checking out.
But don't expect not to get machine gunned down at the end.
Exactly. So with that, that's going to put our third episode of Adjust Your Tracking to an end. This show has been produced by Jessica Linus and Laurel DeGutis, and we have a Gmail account that you can, if you have any comments you want to leave for us, you can email at adjustyourtracking@gmail.com. Leave us any messages you'd like to give us, or you can comment On our website and the post page for it, it's at newsroom.nwfilm.org. You can either click on the podcast tab there and see all our shows, or if you look on the front page of the website, you can see all the Adjust Your Tracking episodes, and you can leave a comment in each post. We'd love to do that. And we also have a Twitter handle, right, Joe?
Yep, at Adjust Your Track.
At Adjust Your Track. Follow us on there. Look for us. I so far have been putting little comments here and there. I'd like Joe to contribute a little bit more. That'd be nice.
Yeah, I just got an iPhone, which was going off the entire time. So now I'm technically equipped to Twitter, guys.
Exactly. He can do that. So, with that, we thank you for listening. And I, as always, want to thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Eric. The survivors of the plane crash are,
damn you.
Technology.
Mute that fucking thing. And just start where you did. The survivors of the,
all right.
Mute that fucking thing.
Mute that fucking phone.
I can start. You want me to?
Yeah. Is there any way we could bring up the nominations on here?
Oh yeah, that's right.
You're going to tack this on at the end of the episode, you motherfucker.
You like that? That was a funny moment. I'm like, Danny McBride. You're like, no.
No.
Every person.
Everybody else in the movie. Patton Oswalt. No. And yeah, he's just... That's the Nick Nolte volcano erupting.